Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darumbal country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. Finally, if you enjoy this poddy, please subscribe, comment, like or share on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
Most of us have grown up swimming at shark-protected beaches so that we would be kept safe. But the irony is that these same protection measures are killing more sharks than humans being killed by sharks. Envoy Shark Cull was aimed at educating us about the truth of these so-called protection measures and to inspire us to challenge and push for change. So how much has changed in the past 3 years?
Andre Burrell is an impact filmmaker and investor. He wears many different hats. Amongst them, he's the founder of Envoy Foundation. He describes himself as a maker of good trouble, and we would certainly have to agree. We first spoke with Andre back in season 2, episode 23, about his documentary Envoy Shark Cull. Please make sure you check that out if you haven't already. But given that he's an insanely busy man and we're now in season 5 of the show, we were well overdue for a catch up to talk about his latest work and projects. So let's dive in. Andre, welcome back to the show. Lovely to be chatting with you today.
Thanks for having me. It doesn't feel like that long, let me tell you. It feels like
it's
we spoke
scary, isn't it?
Pretty recently. And yeah, wow, there you go. But yeah, looking forward to it.
Awesome. Now, we don't need to do the full personal background. Go back to season 2, episode 35. It's all there. But give us a little recap. What have you been up to the last 3 years? You're in Singapore. What's been going on?
Yeah, okay, cool. So look, since we've spoken, you know, the film came out, as in Envoy Shark Cull, the documentary on all the shark control measures, the shark culling programs that you mentioned there. So that film came out and did pretty well in terms of like amount of eyeballs that it reached and sort of awareness that it's raised and things like that. However, what it didn't do is kind of solve the problem. We thought, you know, we hoped it might create so much outrage that the politicians just simply couldn't hide from it and they had to update this program. It would be forced upon them, like it or not. What I underestimated in that calculation when I thought that I might achieve that is just how stubborn politicians are, just how averse they are to following science and following community sentiment and just digging their heels in and sticking with something just because they don't have the political courage to make a change, to do something. So yeah, look, fast forward 3 years, still working on the issue. We've just released a massive report about the Queensland Shark Control Program where we did an independent review of it. We just released that last week or on the weekend even as we're recording. Last year we released one of those on the New South Wales program as well. And we are just like, my day is spent, a good chunk of my day is spent lobbying and trying to get through to these politicians, trying to get meetings with these politicians. However, not only that, because they are so stubborn and they are so difficult to deal with, we work via other avenues as well. And we definitely try and ignite some outrage in the community by spreading awareness and some calls to action, stuff like that. That's kind of the recap on shark related things in terms of where my time's gone. As well as that, there's heaps of other stuff going on. I owned a business in Australia that I sold between last time we spoke and now. That's what brought me to Singapore. So it was a business. It was sold to a French business, but the Asia Pacific head office is here in Singapore. It was sold during COVID, and it was basically a deal won't go ahead unless you get yourself there. So I got myself here because I really wanted out of that business and to be able to focus on this sort of stuff completely full time. So that's what brought me here and haven't left, I guess. It's a really cool base to live and to travel from. So close. I can zip to the Maldives and be diving with tiger sharks in like 4 hours. It's really cool. And then obviously something we'll get into later is I'm sure the foundation, Envoy Foundation, which got started off the back of Envoy Shark Cull, Norwegian Whale Reserve, which is a new project. It's literally just been announced and we're making good progress on. So long story short, a lot. A lot has happened.
And do you find Singapore actually a good, if you actually had a choice right now, would you head back to Australia? Or do you think Singapore is actually a good place to network, to get to other places, to find more funding, get more support, more backing, all that kind of stuff? I mean, is it's actually been a positive?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely like probably the biggest financial hub, if not the second to Hong Kong, I'm not actually sure, in Asia. So there is good networks to be had and good access to funding and networking and stuff like that. So definitely it's a good hub to travel from. In terms of would I move back to Australia if I could, I don't think I'm ready yet. To be honest, on reflection, I really think I needed a break from Australia. Like it's especially when you become aware of all the, not the shiny, glossy, veneer version of Australia, that's great, but the true version of Australia when you live there and you're trying to do work in political circles and you look at the destruction that's happening to koala habitat, wombat habitat, you know, native animals like dingoes being controlled on land, sharks in the ocean, and it goes on and on and on, salmon farming in Tasmania. Like it literally doesn't end. And I think what I'm saying there is I needed a bit of a break from it, and it's kind of nice to get away. You zoom out a bit, you look at the bigger picture a bit, and maybe at some point I'll be ready. Maybe some point I'll head back and live on the Sunshine Coast where my dad lives. He's retired now, something like that. I don't know, be close to family as he gets on in the years, maybe. But as at right now, I'm happy to be out, to be very frank.
Yep, I can understand what you're saying there. I've moved to Central Queensland, and it's an adjustment seeing everything firsthand. But anyway, we'll talk about all of this kind of stuff later, because I noticed in one of your reports, I'm jumping well forward here, but I'm in the main area for bycatch, which is not great. Mm. Anyway, so last time when we talked to you on the show, we covered your documentary in a bit of detail. So once again, push for the listeners to firstly go and watch the documentary if you haven't already, but take a listen to our first chat. But as a bit of a recap, just to kind of bring about the crucial talking points and set the scene a bit for our chat today, maybe let's just start with the very basics. Why should we care about protecting sharks?
Sure. I think, look, I'll answer it in two ways, in terms of from a scientific perspective and also a personal perspective. I think I'll start with the personal perspective, and that is someone who's experienced sharks firsthand and seeing what they're actually like and how far that is from the image that Hollywood like to put out there because it sells tickets, and the image that some or a lot of sections of the media like to put out there because it gets headline clicks. Having seen them for what they are and not for what they're portrayed as, I kind of just feel for them as really like wrongly vilified. Like, yes, they make the odd mistake every year. And yes, that mistake can have some pretty serious consequences given their bite force and and the sharpness of their teeth and also the remoteness of the locations where some of these mistakes happen. The outcomes can be tragic and disastrous, but at the end of the day, they're not swimming around with, you know, glowing red eyes with this lust for blood and looking for humans to hunt, like so many people will have you believe. And because that's the way they're portrayed, they're just hunted and slaughtered and killed like ruthlessly. And I just, I don't know. I sympathize for that for some reason, you know, I feel like when I was at school, I probably wasn't the best student, but also feel like I was hard done by teachers quite a bit. So I don't know if it's that, I have no idea, but I can relate to being wrongly vilified, treated poorly for no real reason. So there's that, that's it on a personal perspective. I see that from them for what they are, which is beautiful, cautious, careful, calculated, just nature's perfectly refined apex predator, like amazing. And then, but they're not just swimming around chomping at everything and trying to eat every human they see. It's just not real. So that's from a personal perspective. In terms of, you know, higher level scientific point of view, that's just so critical for our oceans. You know what I mean? Without them, reef systems collapse, fish stocks collapse. Like you need, you know, the analogy that some people use is that they're the white blood cells of the ocean. They go around cleaning up the sick, the diseased, the injured, and keeping the ocean healthy. And I think that's so important. I didn't realize how critical they were. My love from them didn't come for why they're so, how critical they are to the oceans. My love for them came for a different reason, and my want to defend them came from a different reason. But both stories I think are important to tell in balance.
So unfortunately we have the false perception, and that certainly got to a critical point in the 1930s, there or thereabouts in Australia. And we came up with this ingenious idea of, okay, well, let's protect ourselves from sharks. So again, let's do just a basic overview. What are the various controlling methods, or as we all know now, culling methods used? What are they? You know, there's different approaches. So let's just sort of do an overview of it.
Sure. To keep it very high level and very simple, you can always refer to the documentary for the detail, but it's nets and hooks, basically. People hear shark net and they assume it's some sort of barrier, some sort of enclosure, some sort of method of keeping sharks out there and people in here and making beaches safe that way. They're not. A shark net is a fishing net. It's a gill net. It's a set net, basically. It's there to catch and kill everything that swims by. Hopefully there's a bunch of sharks, but there's a bunch of other stuff as well. So nets and then hooks as well. So what they actually do is they place, and this is the crazy part, baited hooks at beaches. So big shark fishing hooks attached to a big, bright, fluorescent floating buoy just behind the surf break at beaches with bait on them. So the idea, there's any shark in the area will be attracted to that bait, get hooked, and then they will come and kill it. If it's a traditional drumline, they call it traditional drumline. We call it catch and kill, a catch and kill drumline. Or if it's a smart drumline, which they use in New South Wales, they will tag and release that shark. But basically, it's a baited hook just behind the surf break, which is kind of sketchy. So that's the two main methods. And you're right. You pointed out 1937. That's when the program started in New South Wales. It was in response to a series of shark bites. Beaches were becoming more popular, and we were doing some really, really stupid things given that beaches were becoming more popular. We were, there was still blood and guts, and offal was allowed to be dumped down waterways and off beaches, and ships that come past could dump anything into the ocean that they wanted. You just create this great big, basically shark attractant at beaches because beach culture was just evolving and environmental laws were non-existent. So that's why there was a spike in shark bites around then. Lack of education, lack of knowledge, crazy dumping practices going on. And then the response was to go and kill a bunch of them. But on reflection, the shark numbers were never the problem.
Is there a better way? Because, I mean, Australia has the dishonour of being one of the few countries in the world that still have these shark culling programs. And if we look to, you know, Western Australia, for example, they've abandoned their shark culling methods and adopted non-lethal alternatives. Mm. So what are some of the alternative options?
There's a lot of better ways, and there's not one silver bullet, which is what sometimes would be nicer if there was, because you just give one answer and go, bang, we do this, problem solved. But there's not. So I'll run you through a few. Number one is look at a more holistic look at the ecosystem. For example, in Southern California, great white sharks are at surf beaches basically all day, every day. If you search in Southern California, there was a study that came out, you have like a 99% chance of interacting with a great white shark, as in being in the area of one. But there's no or very, 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 very few incidents. It just doesn't happen. And one of the theories around that is there's quite healthy seal populations in that part of the world. So the food source is abundant-ish. And sharks don't get desperate and don't have to look for other things, you know. You can make the same argument for fish stocks. So that's one. At a very, very high level look, it's not always the shark's fault, in the sense that if you've taken away all its food sources and you've got desperate, hungry sharks out there, what do you think is going to happen? That's a very big picture view. To zoom in a little bit, one of the examples that I really like and one of the solutions that I really like is drone surveillance. I much prefer, and I'd feel much safer in the water knowing that there's eyes in the sky and there's a drone watching my back, than I would knowing there's a line of hooks with bait on them behind my back, or a net which might have entangled something already and is attracting sharks to that smell. I feel much better knowing that there's eyes in the sky watching me than that scenario. As well as that, there's personal deterrents you can wear, electrical deterrents you can put on the bottom of your board or on your ankle. And they emit a strong electric field. Sharks don't like that because they have electrical sensors on their nose. They swim up. They essentially get a zap, I guess is the easiest way to explain it. They go, oh, what is that? I don't like that. And they leave. All sorts of other areas. There are barriers. What people think shark nets are, which is sharks out there, people in here, an actual proper enclosure, that's actually a shark barrier. And those do exist. They're just not widely used. They're not suitable for all conditions and all beaches, but they are suitable in a lot. Western Australia have quite a few of them now. on Perth beaches, and they're really good. They do what people think shark nets do. So that's just a few. There's a lot more. And community education's another one to understand when is safe to go in the water, when might not be so wise to go in the water, when's a higher risk time in the water. That's just not taught in Australia and in a lot of places, but it's just not taught. So people make poor decisions, not because there's anything, you know, not because they're silly, not because anything of their fault. They just haven't been taught.
Now, you've just, you've mentioned it, you've just released an independent review on the shark meshing program, New South Wales. It's not the first review that you've undertaken. You've done one for Queensland previously, the year prior.
Other way around, but yeah. So with our first one was New South Wales, which was last year.
That's right.
We just released the Queensland one, but yeah, that's the first two. They're quite resource intensive documents. We definitely underestimated doing both of them, but they're very well worth the exercise, and they get good information into the public domain.
So what's the goal? What's the purpose of these reports?
No one really has, be it a journalist, be it a politician, be it the member of the public, no one has hundreds or, well, I'd even argue thousands of hours to do a deep dive on this topic and truly understand it and understand all the nuance of it. So the purpose is to do that for them, condense it down into the smallest possible package, which is still quite large because there's a lot of information there, and have it as a tool for lobbying, for activism, for having important conversations, for educating the media so that their reporting can be better and more accurate and it's more insightful. So it's really a tool that we felt a hell of a lot of resources that go into it and so much fact-checking and research, and it's pretty intense. However, the benefit you get out of it, and it's quite a long-living document. Like, it's not like it's released like a press release and then maybe media pick it up or media don't, and it dies 2 days later. It's a document you can use to have these important conversations and point to important facts that people might not be aware of in a document with a citation for years to come. Hopefully we're not doing this for years longer, but yeah.
Well, firstly, credit where it's due, because as you've mentioned, like, it takes so much time and effort and research to put a document like this together, and you've now done, you know, more than one. Let's start with the New South Wales one first, because that's the one that came out last year. That was looking into the shark meshing program. You came away from that with some key recommendations to the state government. So what's the response been like from the government, and what would you like listeners to know about the shark meshing program?
Sure. Okay. So I think the one point in there was quite a few recommendations in there, and we don't have time to go over all of them, but they are available on our website if you do want to go do a deep dive. But I think the one that we really discovered, and I think is a critical one, and no one really is aware of, even the politicians that are responsible for these portfolios aren't aware of, is the New South Wales program can only operate through a legal quirk. So the New South Wales program, it kills a bunch of protected and threatened species because these shark nets are indiscriminate and they kill a bunch of turtles and dolphins and all sorts of stuff. That is illegal. Even for the government to do, that is illegal. The only way it becomes legal is through this quirky document called a joint management agreement, which is done between the Department of Environment and the Department of Primary Industries. And it essentially provides Department of Primary Industries a legal defense to kill a bunch of protected and threatened species. Now, no one really understood how this document worked or its impact of it, but essentially what it means is Department of Environment could tomorrow, with 14 days notice, terminate that joint management agreement. They could go, DPI, you are not meeting your objectives, which they're not. No one disputes that. You're not meeting your objectives. We are terminating the JMA. In 14 days, when that takes effect, DPI no longer have their legal defense to go and kill protected and threatened species. It's essentially a trump card that could be played, or rather a trump card that DPI currently holds that you can take off them. And it would essentially force the shark meshing program to stop, or for them to operate in a way without killing protected and threatened species, which they can't do. So that was one really sort of groundbreaking thing in there. Look, we know we're aware in terms of their response to the report. Official response is kind of non-existent. They want to pretend it doesn't exist. Through doing freedom of information requests, we know they got it. We know it circulated the department through seeing internal emails. We know that the Environment Minister was briefed on it. We know that the Environment Minister is aware of this joint management agreement and that they actually have the power to end the shark meshing program. So yeah, it definitely did the rounds within government. People are definitely aware of things that they weren't aware of before, even within their own program and their own portfolio. So yeah, it also got a great response media wise in terms of, we did get some good airtime for the issue, made people more aware of the issue. So, yeah, that's kind of a little summary. There's a lot of recommendations. I'm not going to go into every single one, but do have a look if you're interested.
And then I suppose just quickly following on from that, jumping to the Queensland one, on the state level here in Queensland, we've got the Animal Care and Protection Act. And then federally, of course, you've got the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. But the Queensland Act, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the shark cull program is exempt because it apparently meets certain criteria. And you potentially are arguing in the document that they don't meet the criteria. And if they weren't then like exempt from that act, would they be adhering to the act? So can you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, again, another quirk of government and another quirk of, I guess, legislation and stuff like that. So the Animal Care and Protection Act in Queensland is basically animal welfare laws. They've written a clause specifically in that, specifically naming the shark control program to say it is exempt from this act under these circumstances, ABC. Now, the Queensland Shark Control Program take that and use that as a blanket exemption. They go, hey, we're exempt, full stop. Look, it's in the animal welfare, it's in the animal welfare legislation here. We're exempt, we can do what we want. And don't make no mistake, that program's like daily operations are animal cruelty. You've got animals on hooks or in nets dying and suffering for hours. You've also got ones that are found to be alive that are then killed in a horribly slow and painful and incompetent, inhumane way. So make no mistake, it's a breach of the Animal Care and Protection Act. However, the department say, no, we've got this exemption, so we're cool. However, when you look at the exemption, it's not as broad as they claim it is. So there's basically three criteria that they need to tick. And our position is that when you are coming and killing a shark with a knife or with a shotgun shell, which is the way they do it, you're not actually meeting one of those criteria. So if the shark dies on a hook, sure, exemption applies. If it dies tangled in a net, sure, your exemption as you've written it applies. However, when you come and kill a shark, how the exemption's currently written, our position is doesn't apply. So each one of those should be prosecutable under animal welfare laws. But surprise, surprise, they're not, because guess who investigates animal cruelty in Queensland? It's Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, who runs the shark control program.
The lack of willingness to effect change, both New South Wales and Queensland, is it simply don't want to create public uproar, lose my vote, lose my position, purely a selfishly motivated outcome? Is it really that, or are there other underlying factors that are just not, you know, allowing for the change to happen?
In my 4 years in this space, I've come to the firm conclusion that it's all politics. It's 100% politics. They're scared of the situation where drumlines or nets get removed from a particular beach. Something happens at that beach, which currently happens anyway, for the record. Almost 100 shark bites at what they like to call protected beaches, beaches with nets and drumlines. Almost 100 shark bites between the two states at beaches with nets and drumlines. So it's already happening. But they are scared of the media narrative where equipment comes out because it needs to happen. It's the right thing to do. It's where we should be heading. Bite happens, they get crucified by the media. That's it. That the end of story, that's what they're scared of. The funny thing is, the minister that should be making the decision is the Minister for Agriculture and Fisheries in both states. They're not actually going to lose votes about this because the ag minister in both states is always from a regional rural electorate. Their voters could not actually care less about shark control program or the shark meshing program either way. So they are probably not going to lose votes. The mandate comes from higher, and the only person higher is the premier. The mandate comes from higher to be like, no, this could be a bad look for us as a party. You will not change it. And we have it on good authority that instruction does come down. And it's all down to that. It is the party is scared that if we're the one to take this decision, something happens, which it inevitably will, because it already does, even with the equipment there, we will be blamed. We're scared of the media backlash. The whole issue boils down to that. It's that simple.
And could you comment on the types of language that's used when the government's communicating the shark control programs? Like, is it clear? Is it direct communication to the public, or would you say it's a bit deceptive?
Yeah, look, this we covered this in depth in the Queensland report. We did a whole table on all the different types of deceptive language they use and all the different ways they're clearly aiming to deceive the public. Like, it's really clear. But like, for example, a very simple one is they say euthanize instead of kill when they kill sharks. You look up the dictionary definition of euthanize, and it's for the benefit of the animal. That's not what this program is. These animals aren't killed for the benefit of the animal because they're suffering or because they're dying or because they're unwell. They're killed to control their populations. It's a shark cull, and you're killing sharks. It's that simple. Stop trying to sugarcoat it and sanitize it by saying euthanize. As well as that, look, there's a whole bunch of other ones. They claim that, for example, in Queensland, one we take real issue is they claim that to reduce bycatch, we use drum lines wherever possible instead of nets. That's simply untrue. Everywhere a net currently is, it would be possible to put a drum line or multiple drum lines there if that's what they wanted to do, instead of the net. So that they just, it's simple as that. As simple as saying we do this wherever possible. I don't know what their definition of wherever possible is, but it's vague. Not the same as
you
mine.
You want vagueness, right? So
that's right. So and they look
accountability.
Yeah, and there's a shopping list of examples like this. Literally in the report, the latest report, we have a whole table of them, and we kind of pick them apart as to why each one's either bordering on deceptive or maybe a half truth versus just out and out lie.
But change is possible. Ending these programs is possible. We've seen examples all over the world, Hawaii, other parts. But a very more recent one, and closer to home, being a local podcast, Dunedin, New Zealand. Tell us that because that's an example you actually make mention of in the report. But what drives those changes? Why do those local authorities actually listen and say, you know what, actually we will take it out?
Yeah, very, very good question. So the Dunedin example, there was shark nets there for a long time, and there was for a few years, and we're only tracing this through like news reports and things like research we can do from here. We're not Dunedin locals. We're not, you know, on the ground there. So we're piecing together the information from what we have. It's publicly accessible. But from there, there was a move to get it removed for quite some time. Same as the programs here. This doesn't work. It's quite outdated. It's quite cruel. There's a massive uproar from a very loud minority saying, if you do this, it'll be a bloodbath. You know, people are going to get butchered. It's going to be so on and so forth. That stalled it a few years by the looks of it. That kind of outcry stalls it a bit, but eventually it happened. Eventually it did happen. Shark nets were removed from Dunedin. And what do you know? There literally hasn't been a shark bite since. Like nothing. Despite all the uproar and despite all the outcry and despite saying, you know, we're going to be on the menu and so on and so forth. It's just not true. It just doesn't happen. So it's a good example. Hawaii as well is another one. They killed sharks for a lot of years and they found it made absolutely zero difference, statistical difference to shark bites happening or not happening. It's just not effective. And the reason that is these animals are so migratory. So for example, Dunedin, they were primarily concerned with white sharks, in Hawaii, primarily concerned with tiger sharks. You can't kill a bunch of those and make an area safe. It's a migratory species. The ones you killed today were not going to be there tomorrow. And the ones that you haven't killed yet, because they're on their way from somewhere, are going to turn up tomorrow, regardless of how many you killed yesterday. It's a migratory species, and you literally can't. You can't cull a migratory species to try and protect a little local area. I get why maybe the program started. I do kind of understand why in 1937 or 1962, maybe we didn't know we definitely didn't know as much as we know now about how migratory these species are, the vast distances they swim. Maybe we thought there was local populations of white sharks. Maybe we thought there's a local tiger shark hanging out all year round and it was dangerous. And if we kill it, then it'll be gone and this beach will be safe for the foreseeable future. Maybe we thought that, but the point is we know better now. You can't kill the local white sharks at Dunedin because that's not a thing. can't kill the local tiger sharks in Hawaii because that's not a thing.
And with the current methods, I mean, the drum lines in particular, I suppose, but also the nets when animals get caught up in them, is there any potential for these apparatuses to actually be attractants to sharks in the area?
Yeah, look, this is one of the things that I was really shocked at when we started going through the data. So the government gave us all their catch and kill records since 1962 in Queensland, since 1937 in New South Wales. Not willingly, but we got them eventually. And there it tells you what species it was, where it was caught, time of day, blah, 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 blah. And then there's a comments field. And that comments field is a treasure trove of information, because what you end up finding is that a lot of sharks and other animals, turtles, dolphins, rays, whales, you name it, there's a comment there saying, you know, had been predated upon. Animal is missing from behind the pectoral fins. Only head left. Had large bite mark out of stomach. Blah, blah, blah. All these comments saying, basically, these animals are being predated on. Then we went a step further and we actually also applied for images to do with the shark control program's catch, which they've only started documenting recently. So the old records don't have it. But the new ones, there's an image for every animal they catch and kill. And lo and behold, just like the comments fields, it's a treasure trove of animals that have huge bite marks out of them. So clearly, you're bringing large sharks, going by the bite mark, as in the jaw size, you're clearly bringing large sharks into the area for a feed. That is absolutely certain. And then the question is, what does that shark then do? Does it swim off fat and happy? Does it stay in the area because it's starting to be habituated to know, oh, there's food around here? So the fact that sharks are brought in and that predation happens, absolute fact for sure. And I don't see why that isn't spoken about more and why, you know, politicians aren't made to answer for that. Because maybe that explains the 100 shark bites that have happened, 100 or so, not the exact number, the 100 or so shark bites that have happened at these so-called protected beaches. Maybe it's because you're running a shark feeding program, essentially. So, yeah, the programs pose more problems than they offer solutions, that's for sure.
But now let's expand on another part, the bycatch, because this is not just there to catch sharks, as perhaps intended. There's a direct impact to the greater ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you name a relatively large in size animal that lives in the ocean that you love, it's been caught in a shark net or hooked on a drum line pretty much. Like anything that's distributed through those areas and is of a size that can get hooked or tangled in a net does. So turtles, dolphins, rays, whales, we've got dead manta rays, we've got we've got dolphins of just about any species, you name it, that are dead, that have been caught dead in nets, turtles, loggerheads, you know, which are in loggerheads as well, but what I meant to say was leatherbacks, which are in a terrible way population wise such a big, beautiful prehistoric animal, constantly getting caught and killed in these devices. And humpback whales is obviously one that gets a lot of attention. Humpback whales get entangled 10 to 15 times a year along the east coast of Australia. New South Wales take their nets out for whale migration season to avoid this, but Queensland do not. So just Queensland alone catches 10 to 15 humpbacks a year. A lot are released and they're celebrated as a happy news story release, but there's no studies done into post-release mortality. We don't know if they make it back down to Antarctica to feed. If they do, we don't know if they make it back. Like there's just... Yeah, the whole podcast could honestly just be on bycatch. It's insane, and they make no effort to study post-release mortality other than they just like to say, you know, trot out their release numbers and say, oh, yeah, but this many released alive, which is not really a high number anyway, but then you've got zero data to show how many of those actually survive. This is what gets most people, the bycatch. So a lot of people can take or leave sharks, you know what I mean? And maybe the fear outweighs the logic or the compassion a little bit. Yep. But with bycatch, this is what really gets most people like riled up.
Because that's the beloved animals, isn't it? Everyone loves a whale, everyone loves a dolphin, cute turtles.
And potentially our most famous visitor also, Migaloo.
Yeah, Migaloo, exactly right. So Migaloo hasn't been seen for a few years. And you know, anecdotally between scientists and photographers and cinematographers, anyone with an interest in knowing where Migaloo is, Anecdotally, like there's not high hopes that he's still alive. So then that as part of preparing this report, that kind of piqued our interest and went, I wonder if there's missing shark control program or equipment around the time, the last time he was seen. Like, could that be it? You know, long shot, but could be. And what do you know? There is a shark net that went missing, vanished, never recovered, never to be seen again, around an area where he's known to be, at a time of year he's known to be, and he hasn't been seen since. So we posed the question. We didn't say this happened, like, but we posed the question in the report to say, could this be an explanation for why Migaloo hasn't seen? Things align, you know, sort of stars align, data points align. Could this be one? And yeah, that's an angle that the media certainly seem to have taken and run with. And they're posing the question now, which is good to see, because my opinion is a program like this, where you're using taxpayer funds to go and kill a bunch of wildlife, right? Which is what these programs are fundamentally. A program like that needs to be above reproach. They need their I's dotted. They need their T's crossed. They need to have their house so in order if that's what your program is going to be. And in the report, actually, when we raised this question of this, could this be what happened to Migaloo, we invited a response from the department. So we said we invite the department to say this did not happen and to provide us of evidence that it didn't. And they haven't been able to. And what I've been told, I think there's some ruffled feathers in the department there. But look, our maintaining a relationship, maintaining a positive relationship with that department is challenging because of how constantly and relentlessly we do expose their dirty work. It's hard to maintain a positive relationship there anyway. So, us asking some hard questions of them, which the media then love and then double down on that hard question, it seems to have ruffled some feathers, but so it should. I mean, you're running a program that kills a bunch of wildlife. You might have killed Migaloo. You should be able to answer some hard questions. And if you don't have the data and the science and the evidence to support it, well, that's on you, not on us.
So we've covered a lot on the ethics of these programs, the impact on the marine environment, the ineffectiveness of this, the science, the evidence backs it. You've released a documentary to deliver this message. You're now putting heart and soul and time into these intense reports. The passion is there. You've now released a foundation, the Envoy Foundation, but that's also kind of broadening a little bit. So tell us about Envoy Foundation, its purpose, why you established it, and the kind of work you're hoping to do.
Yeah, sure. So the foundation came after the film, not the other way around, which is a question I get a couple of times. So the film made me realize there's all these great people out there doing great work that maybe are sometimes lacking in certain skill sets that would be helpful for them to scale their work, or resources. Be it funding or be it what else, to really take their work to the next level. And I noticed that as a common thread through all the people we spoke with and interviewed for the film. I was like, wow, this could, like, you could be doing so much more, be so much more impactful, and no discredit to them at all. It's like, you don't have the support. Activism's hard, you know, it's really, really hard out there. So then I just thought, wouldn't it be cool to put something together that, as long as certain criteria are ticked and values are aligned, that to have an NGO that can not just go and do our own projects, but also help to support and scale the work of other people doing important things on the ground in other areas. So that's the concept there. That's where it came from. We like projects or people to be ticking two boxes out of five, minimum of two out of five. So we try to work across climate, oceans, freshwater, earth, or animals, and ideally ticking both, which most campaigns do, or most science does. You know, if you're looking at climate, you're probably looking at its impact on animals as well. If you're looking at oceans, very correlated. If you're looking at earth related stuff, so on and so forth. So yeah, those are the five kind of core pillars of areas we think need a lot of help and a lot of support. And it's really, yes, there's some projects and some campaigns and some things we'll do ourselves, but it's also about supporting and amplifying work others are doing who may just not have the knowledge or experience or skill set that's required to take their project to the next level.
And you've also got a members app. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the members app is something we're going to be doing a little bit more in future. We've launched it as kind of sort of just beta testing at the moment, where we've invited a select group of members where basically you can go on and you can vote for projects and things like that. So basically it's somewhere where you can submit a project to us. If that project is accepted after some due diligence, then it can go on the app and people can vote for it or choose to support it. So there's basically an in-app kind of currency, like tokens. You can do a membership each month for, you know, whatever it is, $10, $50, $100 a month, and you get tokens for that. And then you can vote for projects you like or support things you like on there. And those tokens basically get then go back to that project in real world dollars. So you can use them to support articles we publish and stories we publish on the app if you want to support us, or they can be used on projects when we start listing them to support other people's work as well. So that's the concept. It'll require a lot of community building, and obviously we need to get it to a critical mass for it to be truly an enticing place for people to come. That's where we'd like to get it to, but for now it's just a tool where people can come, stay up to date on what we're doing, support us a little bit each month through those memberships. Yeah.
So there's a particular project that, or campaign, or I don't know how we're going to call it, but Norwegian Whale Reserve. Tell us a little bit about this entity that you've found yourself involved with.
Yeah, sure. So it was probably about a couple of years ago, I saw this horrible footage doing the rounds of this orca, Kiska, who was in Marineland, Canada. And they called her the loneliest orca in the world or something to that effect. She'd been alone for a long time, lost a lot of calves after being artificially inseminated, lost a lot of calves. And there's this footage of her just swimming in circles, banging her head on the wall, like just horrible, right? I started looking into it, being like, you know, there's been an empty the tanks movement for a long time, but nowhere for these animals to actually go. So I started looking around, found one project that looked like they were doing something in this space, did a little bit of due diligence, kind of went, I don't think they're as close as they need to be to save these animals in a relatively short period of time, get them out of tanks. So started looking at doing it ourselves, basically. Started looking around and being like, okay, what boxes would you need to tick to build an open sea sanctuary for these animals, right? They can't just be released. They don't have the skills to survive in the wild, but they can't be in these horrible little concrete tanks anymore, right? So how do you create an open sea sanctuary that is a massive space, as close to the wild as you can possibly achieve, but is still fenced in so that they can stay around, be cared for, be fed, so on and so forth, because they won't survive in the wild. Started looking around, started looking where in the world would tick those boxes in terms of geography. Ideally, you want a fjord or a bay or a sound or something like that, so you can have a massive area but a fairly small mouth that you have to net off, because obviously the bigger the pen, the bigger the chance of failure there would be. You need to be in relatively cold conditions if it's going to be for orcas or belugas or sort of Arctic species. It needs to be in relatively cold conditions. You need political stability, et cetera, et cetera. So I built this shopping list of, okay, where could you build something like this? And more or less, like, I don't want to overstate it too much, but kind of more or less all roads pointed to Scandinavia. And then beyond that, then we started looking around Norway because of some connections we had there, and actually found a group, a local group trying to do something similar. So we had a call with them and got together and essentially decided to join forces. So became a part of the organization, which is Norwegian Whale Reserve. It's a not-for-profit in Norway. And trying to make progress towards building somewhere to get these poor animals that are so smart and so intelligent and so, you know, we don't even understand how intelligent and how smart and how complex their communication is, to get them out of these horrible, horrible conditions and give them a better life, which I think is what's kind of missing from that empty the tanks, anti-captivity movement. It's all well and good to be anti-captivity, which I couldn't agree with more. I don't want to see them in captivity either, but there's got to be a solution. There's got to be a place for them to go. And that's what I guess we hope Norwegian Whale Reserve can be.
Looking at the footage of this area on the website, it looks pretty perfect. But I suppose we do have to ask the question, because Norway does have a commercial whaling industry. So why choose Norway? Why that location?
Yeah, look, like I said, there's a lot of criteria that you've got to get right for an area to even be under consideration. And that list becomes pretty small. There's not a lot of countries to choose from. And you need to, yeah, like I said, you need the geographical features, the climatic, you know, the right climate. You need political stability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Norway, I get the question, like Norway, Wales, why would this be the right place? However, on top of that list of criteria too, you also need to have a town that's willing to have you or a region that's willing to have you and essentially give you hundreds or thousands of acres of space to use. So essentially this just ended up standing out head and shoulders. It was a community that really wanted it and really supported it. Really good geographically speaking, really good political climate in terms of stable and things like that. They don't allow captivity in Norway. So their hands are clean in that respect. Obviously the whaling thing is a concern, but hopefully this can be the start of that changing. You know, a lot of the Norwegian public are not in support of whaling. It's just something that's existed for a long time. There's a strong lobby and a strong industry behind it. So having something like this in that country might sway that even further. And when you look at other places, you know, if you wanted to, I guess, get really, I guess, high and mighty about it and be like, okay, we're only going to go to places that have clean hands. Well, I think your list that like totally cleans hands, your list then becomes, I think, zero. You know what I mean? Like what's being done, what's happening to the resident orcas in the Pacific Northwest, you know, Canada's hands certainly aren't clean. That could be a place you could have a reserve or a sanctuary. America's hands certainly aren't clean in terms of how many orcas they have in captivity, what they're doing to wild populations in the Pacific Northwest there, or failing to protect them there. You know, geographically speaking, there might be some places where America could have been suitable, but you know, if you're looking for places that only have totally clean hands, the list goes from very small already to, I think, zero, as far as I'm aware.
I think it's a fantastic tactical play here because I went down a rabbit hole looking into this. I've traveled Norway. This is by Hammerfest, supposedly the world's most northernmost town. I think from a tourism point of view, this would be amazing for them because the whales are there. You can see them and you can see maybe different species. And like you say, it is true because the most of the public is the industry. The whaling industry is actually more now reliant on the export industry. So it's exporting to places like Japan and Iceland. Locally, actually, there is a movement of they're not interested. So this could be another catalyst. And I think it's a smart move. Create this endearment, create this education program. It doesn't just have to be a sanctuary. So absolutely wonderful. But my question has to be, you're not moving a goldfish. You're transporting a whale. Now, are you going to lead it by you know, from Canada across? How are you transporting these things? I mean, that's that logistical question in my mind. That's an important one.
And it's a fair question. And there's a couple of points to make here. First of all these orca that are in captivity, they got there somehow and they were usually flown halfway around the world to get there. Like not a lot were caught, you know, taken out of the ocean, dumped in a coastal marine park right there. They've flown halfway around the world, the whole way around the world, something like that. They've already been flown to get in captivity, providing they're healthy enough. There's no problem to do that again to get them out of captivity. DHL, in fact, have a commitment to help get animals out of captivity. So there's a commitment where basically, long and short of it, they will help to fly an animal out of captivity back into a situation like this. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, really, really, really good. We're in discussions with some whale owners at the moment, trying to get letters of intent out of them to be like, yes, if you open and that you tick these boxes, we will release this whale to you. So we're working on that. Obviously, have done environmental testing. Site looks just amazing, like amazing. Got to do consequence analysis and stuff to tick some boxes for the municipality there. That's kind of what we're working on right now. Do some consequence analysis for the municipality to know all the good, all the bad, everything clear by an independent third party to report on what this project will do, both the good and the bad. And then from there, once we have letters of intent, that consequence analysis comes back good, environmental testing has already come back good, we want to kind of put this thing into overdrive and get it built and get it operational absolutely ASAP. once we're through this kind of, I don't want to call it red tape, because it's probably not quite fair either, that they are, it is reasonable steps we need to take. But once we get through these hurdles, I really want to get on with it.
Do you have a kind of idea in your mind in terms of timeline to when, you know, that opening will be?
I'm also just like a wildly ambitious person that in every area of my life. And impatient as well. Correct. So look, I would love to see it open next year and welcome Wales next year. So I think, you know, that there's other projects that have attempted this before in other parts of the world, and they've been like 7 years in and got absolutely zero to show for it. We are a year in and already have environmental testing and a bunch of other boxes ticked that no other project has ever ticked. So we're definitely like, I guess, in the lead, not that it's a competition. I'd love to see a bunch of these pop up all around the world and a bunch of animals get taken out of captivity and put in reserves like this. But, you know, if it were in a competition, I'd say we're definitely in the lead, and I want to compress that time frame of what it's going to take to do it to the absolute shortest possible time, because every day it's not open is either another day that animals are suffering in captivity or getting sick and dying in captivity, the ultimate worst case scenario. So I would love next year. That's obviously don't hold me to that, not a guarantee. There's a lot of factors out of our control, but that's what we'd love to do.
So how can we, the listener, get behind it? How can we enable this dream to become a reality?
Look, it's a very good question. And at the moment, with the stage the project is at and needing this consequence analysis as the next step, which is basically the final tick box from the local government there, from the local municipality, we really don't want to go out on a massive fundraising drive, say, hey, we want to build this and we need $2 million until we've ticked that box, because that box gives us certainty that this thing is actually going to happen. I don't want to fundraise promising something that might not happen. So after that happens, you'll definitely see like a Kickstarter campaign or something trying to raise a couple of $1 million, whatever fundraising method we use to get this thing built. As of today, if you do want to help us get through these hurdles where it's still in the, you know,
conceptual phase,
not absolute certainty that we're building this thing. If you do want to support us at this stage, can go to norwegianwhalereserve.org and help contribute funds, which will go directly to that report. No one on the board draws a salary, have no employees, like every cent goes into the steps and the boxes we need to tick. So you can do that. Obviously, if you're a bigger donor or a bigger funder that would like to contribute more substantially, obviously feel free to reach out. I'd love to have a conversation. We just need a little bit more funding that we're kind of doing on the quiet because we don't want to false promises. We need a bit more funding to get through this phase. And then from there, you will hear us come out all guns blazing, calling for funding to get this thing built, because once it's absolutely real, it's tangible, you can taste it, we know what it's going to cost to build and we just need the money, then it's just going to come down to that, raising that in the shortest period of time possible and building that as fast as possible. And I don't think that part will be that challenging, to be very frank with you. And again, maybe this is the forever optimist coming out of me, but I feel like once it's real and it's happening, we just need to raise X amount of dollars. That whole anti-captivity movement from all around the world, which is so strong, will get behind this. And it doesn't matter if it's a nano with $2 to contribute or if it's some wealthy philanthropist with $2 million to contribute, like it will come. I honestly believe it will happen at that point. It's just, I don't want to go, I really am very conscious of not going out there and making false promises and saying, here's what we're building, this is happening, give us money, before we've just cleared this final hurdle or two. Because there's nothing more distasteful to me than misleading donors and generous people on things that, giving them an impression that give us this money and we're going to go and do this, when in fact you haven't cleared an important regulatory hurdle or two. I just find that it just rubs me the wrong way. So really, maybe to our own detriment, maybe we should be going out making false promises. I don't know. But you know, I just don't like going out and doing things that way.
There's a lot of sort of false sort of impressions of a lot of not-for-profits raising money. You know, where does the money go and how much is actually used? So, you know, it's a very endearing approach you're taking here, and I think that'll win more people and say, okay, when you're ready, I'm ready, and I want to get 100% behind. So it's an amazing sort of concept, but also the approach is I think to be commended as well.
In the meantime, though, people can support Envoy Foundation.
Yep. Hey, so good plug. Thank you. nicely plugged. I'm always bad at that. I'll get a clip behind the ears when people listen to this for not doing that part well enough. But yeah, absolutely. Any support is appreciated. We fund a lot of things ourselves, but you know, the more resources, the faster you can get done, the more you can get done at the end of the day. And yeah, if you're vibing with what we're doing and how we're doing things and how we're trying to be transparent about it and you want to help, very appreciative for that support. Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, money makes the world go around. Can't do things without it. So yeah.
Oh, we know that all too well. now, obviously, the Norwegian Whale Reserve is hugely resource intensive, time intensive, and so on. Have you got something else already on the horizon that you're sort of biting at the chomp, you know, to get stuck into? I mean, I'm sure there is, but. What's on the horizon with other amazing projects?
I've been telling myself this for a while now, and I never achieve it. But I would like to do less. Like I would like to have less plates spinning. I would like to have less plates spinning and apply. I can tell what that laugh is. That's a I can relate laugh. So I'd like to do less and just focus on fewer things and put more time into fewer things. But for some reason, I always find myself in this situation with lots of plates spinning. But I do have a few projects sort of coming to an end, coming to a conclusion, so that hopefully this time I can be disciplined and actually do less but put more time and effort into it. One of those projects, for example, is a documentary series we have coming out about Australia. So it's a three-part natural history docuseries, 50 minutes each episode, like Envoy Shark Cull. It's narrated by Eric Banner. The approach is very different, though, to this film. It is this series. It's not. There's no interviews, no talking heads, no humans in it at all. It's pure natural history of Australia. However, we have a different spin on it than pretty much every natural history doc you've ever seen as well, where we're not afraid to show some of the not so nice stuff as well, some of the horrible things that are happening to Australia's most iconic wildlife, be it humpbacks or kangaroos or wombats or whatever it is. So that's pretty much finished and will be coming out shortly. So that'll be off my plate. There's a few other things that are kind of not worth discussing here, but will be off my plate soon. And then I'd love to just pour time into, you know, the foundation and Norwegian Whale Reserve and a few other bits and pieces, keep going on this shark culling activism and campaign as well. End that, put the last final nails in that coffin. But yeah, I don't know, we'll probably talk in another couple of years and I've failed to achieve that. I've just taken on more than I've taken off my plate, probably.
I'm sensing it won't be 3 years, because with that doco series there might be some different stuff to talk about, because you know, true, we need to see the bad stuff, because we live in a very sort of isolated safe space, but really we're in a bubble, and a lot of it's out of sight, out of mind, and we need to understand and be aware of what's happening and the consequences of what's happening. Andre, you are an absolute inspiration. You truly are. The energy that you pour into your activism and your lead for change is unreal. We need more people like you. But you know, we're hugely privileged to have someone like you on the show. You inspire a lot of our listeners. Our first episode we have of you, you know, a lot of people were really like, wow, that's opened my eyes, literally. But thank you. And this sanctuary, honestly, when that's open, that'll be my reason to go back to Norway. I think it's an amazing concept. The movement is growing. It's actually making the news with other dolphinariums and aquariums and whatever they call them closing here and there. And so, yeah, but what do you do with these precious mammals? So the movement's there. Now we just need the infrastructure, and that's what you're doing. So our listeners will get behind it, I know, but thank you so much. You're incredibly busy, a lot on. Take some time out to come onto the show. We're hugely appreciative of. And again, thank you so much for the amazing work that you do.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And yeah, hopefully all going to plan with the reserve. Maybe you can put some microphones in our suitcase and do record the next step from over there. All things going to plan and pulling it off. So yeah, that would be amazing. Can't wait to speak again next time. Thank you to the audience for your your patience for an hour while I sometimes go on some tangents. And yeah, appreciate you both. Thank you so much. I love your work. Always a great chat. The hour just flew by. So yeah, thank you so much.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.